Thomas Green here with Ethical Marketing Service. On the podcast today, we have Vinay Kumar. Vinay, welcome.
Hey, Thomas. Nice of you to have me on your podcast.
It is my pleasure. Would you like to take a moment and tell the audience a little bit about yourself and what you do?
I always hate talking about myself, but if I had to introduce myself, I'd say it's right now I'm organization development consultant that likes to help professionals get better at what they do. And in terms of my background, I've been through multiple journeys. Started my career in technology, then moved into banking, operations roles, people leadership roles, ran a company for a while, did a few startups that didn't go very well, and then started a consulting firm for the last dozen plus years. So that's what I've been doing.
Is that, am I right in saying that that's leadership based?
Leadership and change management, you know, change. How do you help organizations transform to a desired state from a current state?
Okay. So if you were to have a typical inquiry, someone was to call you up, and they needed your help, what would that conversation go like?
Well, it would be pretty much around, hey, we're having, you know, we're trying to build the organization of the future. We want to check out our people and our talent. Do we have the right folks? How can we develop them? How can we get them to be future ready? That's one part. The other time, sometimes we have organizations call up and say, we need help in, facilitating our team to come together and align in one direction and own the future that they're going to create. So those are typically the kinds of conversations.
So that's one of the things which I think I got in the message before, in our communication before we arranged the podcast, was it's hard enough to have that when you're actually in an office together, but when you're remote, it's even more difficult. So what would you say, or what some tips that you can think of in relation to, I think the term is homogenous.
Yeah. So I would say slowing things down. I've been working virtually and remotely for about 7-8 years on global projects and all of this. And all the pandemic did was it took it away from having an option to work virtually or face-to-face to forcing everyone to go virtually, right? One of the tips I would say is slowing things down. It takes time for a group of people to connect, to align, having more pauses to make sure that everyone's caught up to the conversation. And doing it in bite size. I mean, we could get a group together in a face-to-face environment, for a day or a couple of days to think about strategy. But when you're doing it virtually, imagine everyone being on an online platform for a full day. It's exhausting. So maybe breaking that up into 2 hours or 3 hours every day over a course of a couple of weeks, or give some time between days for people to decompress. Otherwise, what you'll find is everyone starts to multitask and you won't even know they're multitasking.
A little bit of thinking about well-being in there as well then, yeah?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things I've loved doing is, we tried to order these stand-up desks, you know, the either table on tables or the tables that you can just make them right. And once the pandemic started, when we tried to order them, they were just out of stock within a month. It was great. I mean, I think those guys are doing great furniture companies.
I really liked a quote, that I got from your bio or your, I know, I think it was a message actually. And the quote was, command and control leadership is certainly out. Leveraging the collective wisdom is in and here to stay. What are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. And actually, this was when I was working in the corporate world a couple of decades ago. And when I joined after studying into the corporate world, I always noticed that one or two people took charge in front of the room, either the marker, the PowerPoint, or something, and they just drove the conversation. And those meetings, I used to practice the 1,000-yard stare. You know that one, right? Where you're looking at someone, but you're really not there. And I watched my colleagues doing it as well. And then when I started becoming a people manager and getting people in meeting rooms, I was always very conscious of the fact of asking people opinions. How do you do this? What do you do? And I remember having a manager who I reported to very early on once took me aside and said, I was very quiet in meetings. Unless I was called upon, I would never speak. And he took me aside and he said, I didn't hire you for silence. I hired you for what's between your ears. So if you don't speak, I'm going to assume there's nothing. And if you're going to make me ask you, you're making me do a lot of the work. So I need you to speak up a lot more. And I started contributing and I loved it. I mean, I loved being part. I felt a greater sense of ownership and accountability. More of my colleagues started speaking up. We just had a great leader. And that's why that quote resonates for me. That I think a leader's role is to leverage the wisdom of the group. Right? Otherwise, if there is no wisdom in your group and you think you have to do everything as a leader, then you're not a leader. You've just hired a bunch of followers.
It's a great explanation. So how do you implement that in your business?
Let me use a very, very simple thing. I think every organization and every team or small group of people get into a meeting room or on a Zoom call nowadays, and they want to brainstorm a solution to a problem, right? I think brainstorming is the number one technique. But I discovered, learning more about facilitation, that even brainstorming is done sometimes very badly. It's the leader says, okay, guys, any ideas? Very well intentioned. Ask the group and say, let's go around the room. Each one of you throw out an idea. And as they go around the room, it's so hard. And sometimes you see it, not to judge the idea until all the ideas are out there. Right. So at a very simple thing, we do things like, okay, everyone's going to present an idea. This is only the ideation stage. No judging. Each one needs to give at least two ideas. We use post-it notes, or if it's digital, there's digital tools available. And the leader goes last, because there's this tendency in some cultures that the leader goes, the hierarchical leader here, and say, well, okay, let's brainstorm. I think we're going to do this way. The likelihood of his or her team disagreeing with him or her is very low. So we kind of put things like the leader goes last, right? The leader is not the one facilitating the conversation. Give the marker over to someone else. Things like that.
Yeah, it sounds like servant leadership. Have you heard of that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yes, servant leadership is very much aligned to facilitation. You know, there's another phrase that we use, especially when you're trying to train your people. You don't want to be or coach, and mentoring is also very popular, right? And we always say, you don't want to be the sage on the stage, but you want to be a guide by the side. So step aside and guide the group, right?
That's cool. So facilitative leadership, what are the biggest misconceptions that you hear from people who are either inquiring or just general misconceptions?
A lot of facilitative leadership misconceptions are people think it's one, okay, give me a checklist of 10 things I can do that makes me facilitate better and I can do it. The misconception is that it's easy. It is actually a human dynamic, a human-centered approach. So it is more complex than people give it credit for. Yet simple. The second misconception we often see is, if I become a facilitative leader, what about my expertise? Where do I bring it in? What's the role I'm going to play? Wasn't I promoted to be a leader because I'm great at what I do? Everything you're saying is, I shouldn't be great at what I do. I should just hand over to the team. We're actually saying that the misconception is, you obviously you're in a leadership position for a particular reason. But that doesn't mean you need to impose your views or go first. You have to time. So those are the two most common. Oh, the third one is very much about time. That if I facilitate my teams, it'll be easier to get everyone to align on something. The reality is, once you open the Pandora's box of conversations, you might find that there's a lot more ideas flowing than if you had a very narrow conversation. So it might take more time to reach a consensus.
Do you help in relation to communication there then? If everyone now has an opinion, what happens?
Oh, yes. A lot of it is about how do you create a safe space for people to have conversations, and how do you have constructive conflict, but then also find a way to move forward. So there's this whole concept of ways of working, right? So if you're upfront as a group and your ways of working, then it becomes a lot easier to communicate as we move along. Yeah, absolutely.
Interesting. So of your experience working, you say in the last 12 years of doing what you do, what are some of the best teams? What do they have in common? What are the main strengths that you've seen?
You know, I think when teams are formed, every team has a potential to be a great high-performance team. Often I've found that the best or the most high-performing teams, the leaders are not getting in their way. So I would actually not even bring it to the team. Let me give you an example, if I may. I won't name this company, but I was working with the head of sales and he was also happens to be the CEO of a very sales-driven organization. And I met him through some references. And the problem statement he gave to me was, he said, my team rarely, for the last 3 years, has met their stretch numbers, and I feel they're not living up to their potential. And they always have complaints. So classical sales leader who says, my team can do more, right? So I started having a conversation with him, and he said, and I said, who sets the sales targets? He said, I do, along with their inputs. Okay. And they're a good team. I said, do you believe you've hired good people? He said, I've hired really good people. We pay industry average, and our incentives are slightly above industry average. So I said, okay, so you hire good people, you pay them on par with the industry. So what do you think is getting in their way? He said, they don't take ownership. I think they're complacent. They always complain about the market dynamics. So I suggested to him that in the next cycle, if I could come and facilitate a conversation where they set the sales targets, not him. And he was so, you can imagine, right? A leader saying, you're the sales leader, but you don't decide the target. And he looked at me and said, are you crazy? They will give themselves a very doable target and they'll all get the highest incentives for just crossing that. And we had multiple conversations and I said, but I thought you said you've hired smart people. They want to be ambitious. They want to do. So he really, after lots of conversation with him, he says, okay, I'll give it a shot. So I had the group in a room. I interacted with the team. They seemed pretty sharp. As you said, a good team. They're obviously 80%, 88%, 96% of their annual targets for the last few years. And I told them that this year, your leader is going to do something different. He had written the number that he wanted the group to achieve in an envelope, sealed it, and then handed it over to me. And I said, he's got his number there, but I'm going to facilitate a conversation with your group on what do you guys think the number should be for the next financial year. And we just started visioning, doing it. So we said, you know, what could you achieve? What are your asks of leader? What enablers do you need to achieve these numbers, et cetera? And the leader had gone for the day. I sent him away to go do other stuff. He wasn't in the room. And I had to send him out after the morning coffee break because he kept getting in the way, right? He kept jumping in. Oh, yeah, but, you know, this client, there's a huge opportunity here. And I said, go away. At the end of the day, when he came back, the group had distilled up to a number, but they had certain requests in order to get to that number. And they had a probability of achieving that number. They had a pessimistic, optimistic, and a realistic number. And said, okay, so the leader just listened to all of it, and we took a break. The group went off to have coffee. He looked at me and said, I'm blown away. I said, why? Open the envelope. I tore open the envelope. I hadn't looked at it. His number that he had for the group was 15% below the realistic number that the group came up with. Right? And I said, okay, so they're aiming 15% higher than what you had thought of, which was their stretch goal. And, but you do see on the board that in order for them to get to that number, you need to support in this way. And what can you do? What can you not do? So we had that conversation. The group came back in. We did it. And that was the first year that the group exceeded their own numbers.
Amazing.
Let alone the sales leaders' numbers. So was that a great team? I think it was always a great team. I just felt that maybe the environment was holding them back.
Wow.
Long answer to your question. So
it was a great example. And it sort of reminds me of, I've had a couple of conversations regarding the creation of culture. Do you ever cover those topics at all?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And part of being a facilitative leader is about creating a culture. Absolutely. Across the organization, across teams, are very, very critical. It doesn't happen easy. The leader can be asking the group a lot of questions, but the group's also always wondering, this leader never asked me a question. What is he or she doing all of a sudden? Are they checking, are they assessing me? So one of the things that you heard me say earlier, creating that safe space is so critical from a culture building perspective. To know that I can disagree with my supervisor and not get in trouble.
Mm. If they set goals themselves, then they're more likely to achieve them. Whereas if they set goals externally by someone else, then they didn't have any part in that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And we have to have, first the goals are set by the person, then they have a conversation with their supervisor, and the supervisor hasn't even decided what the goals are. Their job is to challenge and coach and mentor and say, what else could you be doing more? Right? It's about questioning.
So how did you get into this line of work?
Completely by accident, as most things are. So I'm a finance person by qualification, finance and technology. So I was running businesses. And I happened to, I mentioned one of my bosses earlier. So let me, you may have heard this quote before. I don't know who to reference it to, but I have learned more from the worst bosses I've ever had than the best ones. And when I had a terrible manager who, I used to go into meetings, me and my colleagues, we just used to tune out. We felt it really was a waste of our time. And one thing I remember walking out of was, and saying when I left that organization, was I never want to make my team members feel that way, the way I used to feel in that meeting. So then I started going in and learning, from others who used to facilitate it. And I was given an opportunity to sponsor some of my team members to go out in a training program. And I went and attended it sitting at the back of the room and kicked it off. And the trainers came in and one of them went into a tell mode, just had death by PowerPoint. And the other one, and that's why I love co-facilitation. The other one said, okay, we'll pause. And what I'm going to get all of you to do is go to your flip charts and have conversations. And you could just see life and energy emerge in that room. And I just stood watching there. And on day two, at the end of day one, I walked up to my HR person and I said, I see these two people facilitating. Can we get rid of that first person who's in a tell mode? And can you just use the other person? And she said, okay, let me go and ask them. And she went and asked the two facilitators, and one of them was very happy to depart because he realized he wasn't getting the attention of the group. And the other person said, I'm happy to facilitate alone, but I need help. And he looked at me and said, you've thrown me under the bus here and asked me to do this. Can you help me co-facilitate the program? And for the next 2 days, I stood in front of this person, co-facilitated, asked questions, and I absolutely loved it. I loved it. Being somebody, a neutral party, and just helping the group learn and engage. And that's how I made lots of mistakes, and he gave me some great feedback, but it also made me go and learn about the skill a lot more. And that's how I got into it.
It's a great story. You mentioned the couple of startups that didn't do very well. Continuing on the line of you learn more from the negative experiences than you do from the positive ones. What did you learn from the startups that didn't do well?
Don't get money too early, too quick. Right? So one is, we believed our own hype. And when we got our funding, there's this concept of burn rate, which you've heard of, right?
Yeah.
Where we spend more than we earn. So we did all of those classical mistakes. And then the first dot-com bust of 2008 came along, and all our clients went, a lot of them shut down. We just went under. No cash to preserve. We were very optimistic. We believed our own hype that this business can never go down. So one mistake is, or one learning is, be optimistic, but have a plan B. Right. So I would probably say that's the biggest. The second one is, have people with you who will be, when things are not going well, at least you want a degree of cautious optimism, not pessimism. Or at least realism is okay. This is a problem. How do we fix it? So solution for it oriented, not problem oriented. So I struggled because I had a couple of colleagues who were more, oh my God, what are we going to do? Oh my God, what are we going to do? How will we cope? Versus, okay, here's a problem. The tone matters, right? So here's a problem. So what are we going to do? Not, oh my God, what are we going to do? Right.
Really interesting. Cause on the first one, it's almost like you say, don't believe your own hype, but it's too far one way. You believe too much. And then the second one is that they don't believe enough. So it's getting that right balance. Would you say that's accurate?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Business decisions, when we make them, keep reserves, right? That's where it is. And then the optimism, rather than say, oh, my God, we made this mistake, say, okay, yeah, we made it. So now what are we going to do about it? How do we fix it? Rather than look in the rearview mirror and discuss everything that we shouldn't have done, it's been done. What do we do? And that's what I mean about be solution-oriented.
Do you facilitate with your team?
When I can, but I'm also very conscious of the fact that there are situations where I cannot be neutral, and we bring in a neutral facilitator to do it. Because then I would prefer to be one of the group and be a participant rather than struggle to be a neutral facilitator.
Interesting. Well, I can hear some kind of the questions in the back of my mind from people who, let's say they run a team and they're not quite sure how to implement. So what would be the first few steps, would you say, in applying facilitative leadership into a company which hasn't previously had that model?
Yeah. So I would say first thing is if you're a manager, you're a leader, you work with groups of people, the first thing for the leader is for him or her to step back a little bit and fundamentally believe, I ask themselves a question. Do I have good people working for me? Do I have smart people in my team? Am I leveraging these people well? Are they all giving the best of the team, to the team? The third one is, do I believe I'm smarter than my team, or are some of my team smarter than I am? So it's almost the first question, right? But this is more about self. If the answers to those questions are, my team is pretty good, I need to get the most out of them, that's when facilitation starts to play a role. Because you've got the preconditions or the prerequisites for facilitation to come in. The second stage of that is, don't facilitate yourself. It's dangerous. It's like asking an amateur to go do cardiac surgery, right? Those are reflective questions, right? That's a really ego provoking question for the leader. Get somebody who is a process facilitator, what we call them group process facilitators. Work with them with a problem statement, and then get the group together, you know, whoever needs to be part of something to get to that problem statement. Get them in a room and take a step back and see what the outcome is. Right? And see what the outcome is. I would say 8 out of 10 times, you will be surprised that the outcome is a lot better than what you expected it to be. And the other 2 times, it's a lot different from what you expected it to be. The different is not bad. Different is just a different way to approach it. But one thing I can guarantee you, if it's process facilitated well, the ownership and accountability of the group to implement that solution is going to be 10 out of 10.
Mm.
And that's
something, if I may, you said about the, is my team smarter than me? I would imagine that a lot of leaders will hesitate to say my team is smarter than me. So would you care to a bit of clarity on that? So the scenarios are, they'd say, oh, my teams are smarter than me, so therefore facilitated leadership is fine by me. But what in the other instance where, yes, I'm actually smarter than my team, what happens then?
Yeah, so I often then ask, why have you hired these people? right? And one of the questions I often ask is, if you believe you're the smartest one in the room, and the team is not as smart as you, then why are you frustrated that they're not able to get it done? Shouldn't you just be doing it yourself? Why are you asking them to take ownership and accountability? And that's when they kind of go, yeah, you're right. So that it's an ego-provoking question, right? Because it's, which leader likes to say, I'm not. They might be smarter than you in other things, and you might be smarter than them in certain other things. As a business leader, you might be awesome in budgeting and, you know, the whole resourcing and the client side, but they may be awesome in the execution and the implementation, or even the client relationships on the delivery side. So what did you hire them for?
Potentially have strength in numbers as well, right? So however many numbers of them there are, there's more than just one. And therefore, you've got multiple people.
Absolutely. And I think that's why we say, right, believe in the wisdom of the group.
Yeah.
And that's why when you say, often, you know, it's a great question to us, when sometimes leaders might say, yeah, most of them are smart. There's one or two who are, right? That's a more common response. And I say, well, what's the value add that they're doing in the business? And that's when they say, yeah, they're doing something. And so believe in that collective wisdom of the group. And that's what facilitation does.
Interesting. Would you like to share what your goals are with your company?
So the goals of the business, and you know, my business partners and I, we kind of, the thing that gets me up in the morning is, if I can help help any professional get better at what they do. And for an organization to say, we've got a bunch of committed people, everyone's working in the same direction, we discuss issues openly, and we're all aligned towards a common vision that we are creating together. That I go to bed that day feeling like I've added some value to people and reduce stress for others. So the goal is to be able to do that for as many, many people as I can, because I'm also part of an organization called the International Association of Facilitators, where we say we promote the power of facilitation. So that's my goal on a daily basis.
Have you got any, other than the ones that you've shared already, have you got any favorite stories, case studies, if you will?
There's so many. I mean, I worked with, there's some interesting scenarios where facilitation or, you know, conversations could use. I can give you an example. I don't know in your part of the world, but where I am, a lot of manufacturing facilities have unionized workforces. And there's this classical thing about union versus management, especially in the labor force. And every year, management and union have to sit together and negotiate. The union comes with a huge ask. The management tries to push it down as, you know, the classical sort of antagonistic or at least polar opposite conversations. Mm-hmm. And I actually worked with a Zen. You know what? Don't go in with your position. Just go into that conversation with the union team next time, asking them what they need, and use this concept of appreciative inquiry, if you're familiar with it. Right? Just ask a lot of questions, acknowledge them, understand, dig deep, spend the next 30 to 40 minutes. Just don't even present your views or your judgment on what they're seeking, but seek to understand. That's a big part of facilitation. And it was quite hilarious because the guy called me about a week later, the one who was coaching and all of this. He called me and said, hey, I went into this and I decided to try it out. And for the first 10 minutes, the union members just refused to keep answering my question. They said, no, you tell us. They were so used to management taking a opposite position, right? But what do you think? He says, I don't want to think at this stage. I just want to understand where it's coming from. And he says, can you write it up on the board? And after 30 minutes, 40 minutes, one of the union members said, what are you trying to do to us? We came in here ready to throw our demands at you. And if you refuse to see to our demands, we had lined up everybody to go on strike. You're making it so difficult for us to strike. I mean, what are you trying to do? And he says, no, I genuinely want to understand. And the union was so confused that their opinion actually matters and that they have to have a basis for their demands, just threw them off. And he came back and he says, you know what? You're right. I mean, I would have just said, you guys want this? We can't do that, but we'll do this instead. And it would have just been, you know, win, lose, or give, take. But I just found that slowing it down and making sure that people don't go in with positions and just have interest-based questions, right? Understand each other, changes the nature of the conversation.
Yeah, it's almost, again, like a communication. It's almost like you're teaching communication in a way. Would you say, what do you think about that?
Yes. Communication, yes, absolutely. There are some core foundations of communication in there. But it's also about being able to, there's the verbal and the nonverbal as well, right? The reading the room, slowing down the pace. So communication is a very, very broad term. But you're absolutely correct. In facilitation, communication plays a very foundational role. But there's a bigger one, which is, I'm going to come back to it. Communication is what also sends the message of whether this is a safe place for everyone to participate and communicate and have a conversation.
What do you think that it doesn't? I mean, because it's obviously useful to an organization, why do you think that it just doesn't get picked up automatically?
I think the biggest thing is time, right? And you use the word communication. You know that when conversations take a lot longer than me walking into your room and say, Thomas, we need to get this, 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 and this done. Can you work on this? Clear up your calendar, focus on this. Okay, see ya. Right? 10-minute meeting. The conversation between Thomas and say, hey, Thomas, what's your priorities like? Or what if we change this up? How's your stakeholders going to do? What are your thoughts? I have this problem. Can you and I sit down and co-create? Who else do we need to get into this room to see how we get to do this together? That's probably going to take it to a whole new level of conversations. So I think everyone's on this Ferris wheel of speed and time that they think facilitation is the fuzzy stuff. It's actually not the fuzzy stuff. It's the core stuff. But I would say time is the biggest one.
Mm. So people are focusing on the short term and it affects the long term, whereas facilitation is essentially focusing on the long term. And in the short term, you get a fairly minuscule amount of pain, but it helps basically in the long term.
But then you get long-term pain, by the way. So to give you an example, that sales leader I told you about, when I told him that I want to get your room to get your sales team in a room, he said, how much time do you need with them? And I asked him, how much time can I have? He said, half a day. And I just looked at him and said, half a day, and you want to get how many people in your sales team? It's 20 people. You want to get 20 people's opinions in half a day and come to this decision on your sales targets for everybody for the next 1 year. Are you kidding me? So he looked at me and said, how much do you need? I said, at least 2 days. And he said, 2 days? But that's 2 days they're not selling. Right? But guess what? I mean, it was short-term pain. 2 days, but that year he was able to get that group to achieve their numbers. But they won the short term gain, but they get a long term pain. He had 2 years of them not meeting their numbers.
Mm.
And by the way, he had tremendous attrition in his team. He thought it was a performance issue. So he let some people go. There were some people who were demotivated because they didn't get their incentives and they just left. And now he changed it. His attrition is also lower. I'm still in touch with him. This was from 6 years ago. And he's still knocking the numbers out of the park.
Good to hear it. Is there anything that you think is valuable to the audience that we haven't spoken about so far?
Yeah, I would say you asked a question a while ago is, How can a company create it? How do leaders learn the skill? And I talked about, get somebody in your firm. But also go out. I would say there are forums, there are communities out there. So I mentioned I'm on the board of an organization called the International Association of Facilitators. There's people from the corporate world, from NGOs, government agencies, whole bunch of people in that organization. There's learning events, webinars. If you are a project manager, program manager, business analyst, HR practitioner, any kind of environment where you lead people or work with groups, or today you have agile scrum masters, agile practitioners, it's an organization I would encourage you to check out and just understand facilitation a bit. Understand it before you dip your toes in it and actually start leveraging it.
Great. I will check it out. Vinay Kumar, where is the best place for people to find you?
You can find me on LinkedIn. Just look for Vinay Kumar and put in my company name, C2COD. You can find me there. Drop me an email at Vinay, V-I-N-A-Y, at C2COD.com. I am on Twitter. I'm on Instagram. I'm there.
You're everywhere.
I think I am. I don't know.
All right, Vinay. Thank you very much for the value you brought today. I particularly like the stories, the examples. I thought they were great. And I will speak to you soon.
Thank you, and you stay safe.
Thanks.